Today is the 26th of the 1st, 2017. I'm interviewing Joseph John King, formerly farming at Te Pahuhi. Joseph is going to tell us about the life and times of his family from the start until today. So, Joe, would you like to tell us your story? Thank you.
My earliest memory is of the earthquake of Tuesday, February 3rd, 1931, at 10:45 in the morning. I was 4 years old at the time and being rowed around with my brother Peter on the Te Pahuhi Lake by Elsie McGoslin. My memory is of the cabbage tree by the lake shaking around and making a great rustling. The quake kept coming, and I remember being taken out of the house and looking up at the cliffs and thinking they were on fire. In actual fact, it was all the rocks and dirt being shaken down and sending up a great cloud of dust. The other thing that comes to mind was of a great moth, probably a puri moth, climbing out of some timber, no doubt agitated by all the shaking that was going on. As the years rolled on, I went to school at 6 and enjoyed school work. I have enjoyed reading ever since. The school roll used to have around 12 to 20, and if it was a very cold and wet day, and the Macrobbies and the Kings weren't at school, the school would close. I don't say this happened very often, but it did happen at the odd time. Of course, there was no bus, and an odd child would ride a horse. An odd child would come on the service car that ran from Napier to Taupo. The rest of us walked. In the summertime, we swam in the lake, and manuka growing on the banks was used as a dressing shed. There was a diving board and a raft anchored about 50 yards off the shore. We all swam by the time we were 6 and had swimming certificates up to 880 yards. There was a roster for cleaning the school. At the end of the year, often Percy Howell would take us to town on the back of his truck. We would be given 5 shillings to have the day in town for cleaning the school. I had no trouble with lessons and enjoyed the Te Pahuhi school.
Where was the Te Pahuhi school relative to the village?
When I went, it was where it is today, yes. Just behind the village. We were very poor, so was everyone. Patched trousers and holes in socks were the norm. I was lucky to have Miss Katnick as a teacher for my last years at Te Pahuhi, a good teacher who got us all on. I remember staying after school to finish work from the day. There was always rivalry between Ahura school and Te Pahuhi school, especially in rugby and basketball. Ahura school nearly always had more pupils than Te Pahuhi, so mostly came out on top. One big event was the 1938 flood, when the only rain gauge at Te Pahuhi was at Rockamona and it overflowed. This was also the wettest year recorded, 105 inches. The flood covered all the flats of the swamp paddock and went in Uncle Jim's house 9 inches. Most fences were broken by slips and hundreds of slips on the faces of the hills. The flood came up to the first oak tree and Dad said that was the height of the 1898 flood. The difference being in 1898, the hills were mostly in bush. By 1938, the hills had been shaken by the 31 earthquake and the bush had been cleared away, so everything was set up for a major flood. I remember following the creek down after it had subsided a little, and trout and eels were all along the banks for us to catch. There was probably so much silt in the water that they couldn't stand it, so came out into the shallow water for some relief. The trout have never been very good since. The road was covered in slips all the way from Esdale. There had been a dance at Te Pahuhi the night before, and a number of people had stayed at the hotel and so were stuck till the road opened. Nearly every day a plane would fly over and bread would be dropped, and sometimes butter and other food. For us children it was all a lot of fun. As there was no machinery of any consequence, it took a long time to clear the road. About the same time as the gang opened the road from Napier, the gang from Taupo End arrived at Tipahui. By 1938, apart from the flood, things were picking up financially. The works camps were closing down and there was no more swaggers on the roads. The first works camp was at Maori Gully with about 50 single men who worked on the road. The road used to wind down in the gully across two bridges and very steeply up the other side. It was filled in and was a vast improvement. Another camp was opposite Peter King's. Another was in front of Ross Ramrell's house. Swaggers used to call regularly. One old chap with a goat would come about every year. We were always a bit scared of the swaggers, but if we thought no one was around, we would yell out from cover and give a bit of cheek. They would come to the door and Mum would fill a billy they always carried with tea and give them a good slice of cake or some tarts, and they would go on their way. There was a camp put up about this time for married couples called the Tin Town, on account of the buildings being lined on the outside with sheets of tin. It was situated where the recreation site is at the turn off to the Ahurukura Road. There were about five houses and several children came to the school. From my earliest days, Ahurukura was always an integral part, apart from the mill, of Tipahui. They had their school of about 30 pupils and a hall, and they always helped to fill the hall when there was some activity on. Apart from dancers, sometimes travelling people would put on a show. It might be music or clowns. One night I remember wrestling going on and five or six bouts for the night. Farming was still hard, but from about 1932 all our produce was bought overseas and every year we produced a bit more and received a bit more for it. So things gradually got better. And this continued right up to after the Second World War. The war changed everything. There was such a change in what people wanted and such a change in machinery. Soon after the war ended, tractors came on the scene, and soon after, aerial top dressing, and all the waste areas of fern and manuka were brought into production. Now, to get back to earlier times, we used horses a lot, and there was a yearly pilgrimage down the Mahuka River on horses with peacow bags. This was a large sack with the opening of the sack sewn up and a slit halfway down one side, which was put across the saddle, and you could fill both sides and still ride quite comfortably. We would fill our peacow bags with quinces and peaches, which grew in abundance, quite untended, and take them home. Uncle Jack farmed where Dave Coles is now, down the Ahurukura Road, and he would want a hand mustering, so Peter and myself would ride out and give him a hand for a few days, a nice change. Then whenever neighbours had stranger sheep than ours, we would ride over and drive them home through the paddocks. A good leading dog was part of the all-dog packs. We did our own shoeing and would saddle up and go pig hunting out the Waitara for a weekend. I remember pig hunting with Peter and Mike Lowry out the Waitara with a 3-0-3 when I was 14 and they were 15 and 13, and nobody was too worried. There was no power, so one of the big chores was getting an adequate supply of wood, mostly matai for the stove and anything for the open fire. As time went on, some people had lighting plants and would have a small engine to charge up batteries for electric lights. We always used candles and kerosene lamps till 1958. A copper was boiled for washing clothes, and once a year soap would be made in the copper. It was a mixture of fat and caustic soda, which would be melted and mixed. When it was cold and set, it would be cut up into suitable blocks. Our diet was very limited, with no fridge and no freezers. A vegetable garden was a must, with the problem of how to keep vegetables for any time. It used to be a feast or a famine. There was plenty of meat with the meat safe in the cool place to keep the meat as long as possible before it would go bad. Mum would make bread, which we all enjoyed, and oatmeal porridge for breakfast. In fact, Dad only ate meat and some vegetables, oatmeal porridge and bread, and kept good health till, in fact, was still working when he was 80. Most years in the winter, one or two wild cattle which lived on the Waka would be shot and packed down on horses. Then it would be beef twice a day. Some would be salted and put down in a barrel to keep it a bit longer. Uncle Jim always had the job of milking the cows. Milk was set in pans and the cream skimmed off and once a week made into butter. Then the milk was fed to pigs. There was always hay making in the summer. Two old draft horses would be put in the hay mower and about 2 acres of grass mowed. Everyone was on the job to get in when it was dry. Mum always drove the car, and there was always a car as early as I can remember, a DeSoto that gave great service for many years. When Mum first had it, it used to take 1.5 hours to drive to town. There were some places, if you met another vehicle, one of you would have to back up to pass. The roads were all metal, and once or twice a year, a grader would grade the road and smooth out all the corrugations. There were roadmen every 15 or 20 miles whose job was to keep the water table open and generally to keep the road in repair. Stock used to run on the road quite freely. In fact, one man used to run his milking cows on the road every day and take them home for milking every night. After the milking next morning, they would be turned out onto the road again for the day. As time went by, the house got too small, so Peter and I slept in a tent for a number of years. Well, in fact, till the tent became rotten. And by that time, my sisters had gone to high school, and so there was room for us in the house again. Dad and Uncle Jim both had orchards with apple trees and plum trees, and the best of all, cherry trees. We would sit up the cherry trees for hours eating cherries. My grandfather had planted lots of walnut trees around the farm, and these were always gathered in April and dried in the sun, and we would eat these for hours too. On the whole, these were great years. We were too young to understand the hardships. We had plenty to eat of plain food and very little sickness, but it all came to an end when we went off to secondary school. I spent 2 years at secondary school and made the first 15 at the Napier Boys High. My first job was at Bissell's Automotive Shop. My wages were 13 shillings and sixpence a week. I had joined the ATC Air Training Corps, and we were going to join the Air Force when we were 17 and a half. However, the war finished just before I was drafted. I left Bissell's and went home to Te Papuhi and worked on the farm for a while, but was unsettled and decided to go and see the world anyway. I got a job on the Rangatira, a ferry boat running between Lyttelton and Wellington, and then got on an overseas ship and spent 3 years roaming the world. I came back to Te Papuhi in 1948 and worked on the farm. Uncle Jim retired and gave me his share in the farm. That was 29,950 at the Te Papuhi before moving to Napier. I had my 21st birthday in London working on Lyons Corner House on the corner of the Strand and Tottenham Court Road. The Union Steamship Company bought a Liberty ship and hired a crew in London, and I was shipped to Baltimore. We went over on the Queen Mary from Southampton to New York, and then I sailed on the Liberty ship, now named the Wairimu, back to New Zealand. I married Yvonne in the Trinity Methodist Church, Clive Square, Napier, on the 12th of August 1950. She died on the 6th of October 2008. We had 59 years of happy times and many years of good memories. We had 5 children who are married with their original partners, have 2 children each, but Janet has 3. They all work for themselves. I have 4 great-grandchildren, 2017. Unfortunately, Dennis died the 14th of March, 2016. A big loss. I now have a friend, Patricia Dick. We have dinner every night at her place or mine. Just a little aside, we had wild cattle running in the bush, and the bull got with the quiet cattle. The bull ran over my father, and I was lucky enough to get it by the tail and swing it onto the ground, so I was able to cut his throat. Another strange thing happened. I saw some wild pigs under a manuka bush. I fired a shot and shot 3 pigs with the one shot.
Goodness me.
And another thing, I bought a Chevrolet car in 1955 and a Sprite caravan 2 years later. We travelled all over New Zealand, spending 6 weeks travelling the South Island. We even used to take it to West Shore for the day and sleep the baby in the caravan while the rest of us had a swim. As far as I know, the first settlers took up land at Te Puhi prior to 1862. Most of the wreckers were lost in the quake of 1931, but I have read a letter of a John Parsons who bought Woodlands, later named Rocamona, 4th of October 1862. 2,000 acres, it had a snug little house, also 2 to 3 miles of fencing, a nice garden with a large quantity of peach trees and a few vines, figs, strawberries and a few apricots. It was built on a small flat hill with a rivulet running at the bottom of the garden, approximately where the old homestead is now, 1992. John Vortier took up land where the entrance to my farm is in 1872. This is before the road to Taupo was opened. My grandfather bought it from Billy Hill in 1875 when he came to Te Puhi. This original hotel was rebuilt with pitsawn timber and a wood shingle roof, but was burnt down in a bushfire in 1897. The Kings then built a house where the hotel was and rebuilt the hotel at the Te Puhi Lake, where the store is now. The hotel was added to when the hotel at the Mohawka River was closed down in 1899. The timber brought over and used to make a 24-room hotel. It was taken down in the 1931 earthquake and rebuilt over the road where it is today. The hotel was leased by the Kings to a Mrs. Joshua and then sold to Alf Pothen in 1926. Where the hotel was shaken down in the quake, Aidan Pothen built a store in 1937. This was sold to Frank Weir in 1948. Then came Ashley Andrews and others. The post office closed on the 30th of November 1986. The original post office was run by the Kings at their houses. It was moved to Howell's store in 1895, which started off as Grant and Howell. The store burnt down in 1923, and their village saloon from over the swamp was moved over for the store. Howell's eventually sold to Tucker, then Levinson and many others. And then Charlie Champion, who leased Andrew's store and moved the post office to the top store in 1966. The old post office and store closed down. The post office finally closed down in 1985. Kings built the first mill. It was driven by a water wheel. Butchers had a mill in front of Peter's Rock Station, and this was later moved to west to the present school. Lee's had a mill on Big Richmond Hill. Holt's mill at Ahurukura started in 1920 and went till 1964. Sundry small mills also operated for some time. Prebenson's and Orbell's by the waterfall above Te Puhi. Odlands also took logs from my farm and milled them in Hastings. And now I have only one small mill, Puller's, left in 1992. There's very little native bush left, but big forests of radiata pine all through the district. The first school in Te Puhi was subsidised household school with 8 pupils, which was established in 1897 on the property of Mr. Jack Bodley at what was locally known as Bodley Town, now on Rock Station, where Mr. Bodley had a transport export business. The school had its beginning in the building set aside for post office purposes, the first teacher being a Miss MacDonald, followed by various other teachers. Roll numbers grew slowly, with 10 on the roll in 1900 and 15 by 1905. Many of the people living near the lake wanted the school sited in a more central position. During a visit to town by Mr. Bodley, the locals took the matter into their own hands, and Bodley removed the school to the site where the present school stands. All moves by Mr. Bodley to have the school returned to its original site were successfully resisted. In 1907, the Education Board assumed full responsibility for the school, and the first teacher, Miss MacPhail, commenced duties with a roll of 11 children. The old building remained in use until 1911, when it was considered too small and was moved over the road, where it is still part of a house. In fact, when Yvonne and myself were married, we lived there for 16 years. A new building, 24 feet by 20 feet, with a porch 18 feet by 6 feet, was completed by the Education Board. Play area, a shelter shed, and a horse paddock were also provided. The present name of Te Pūhui was originally Pūhui. It derived from the pūhui plant, or bindweed, which is a convolvulus type of plant. At one time, the plant was very prolific in the area. The root system is very strong and was used by a food item by the Maoris. There have been two big floods, the first in 1898 and another in 1938. The first didn't do as much damage, as all the hills were covered in bush. The 1938 flood was much more disastrous because of all the slipping of the land due to the 1931 earthquake loosening the soil and the bush being felled off the land.
Whose plane brought the bread over?
I don't know. It was a tiger moth used to come over. Originally, the land had big areas of native bush, especially on the slopes of the Mangahuru Range. Lower down, there were big areas of fern. Along the top of the Mangahuru Range, it was covered in snow tussock and flax, and originally grazed by moa. The bones can be dug up in odd places. After the bush was cleared, it was good for farming for many years, but when the fern was, it gradually reverted to manuka. There were always people to take up sections, many not staying long. The 1880 depression was not noticed too much. By the 1930s, living became very hard, and gradually the land went back to manuka and fern. The farms were abandoned until when I started farming in 1948. There are only 5 resident farmers left in the district. There didn't seem to be any answer to the manuka, biddy-bid and blackberry and rabbits. However, there was movement economically. Britain took all the meat and wool, and we could produce it and continued to do so till they joined the European Common Market. By 1949, the S Forests had taken up land along the Hurukuru Road and had planted many acres of pines. At this time, the Lands and Survey got interested in bringing in land to good pasture. They started in on land along the Hurukuru Road. Also at this stage, aerial top dressing started. With all this activity, it was no time before there were more people about and everyone better off. I built my own airstrip at this stage. There must have been golden years. We didn't realise it at the time. All we could produce was bought for a little bit more each year. There was no major wars. There were no floods, no earthquakes. The power came in 1958 and the automatic telephone in 1970. Then Britain joined the EEC and the debt started piling up by 1975. Now a little bit on the history of the King family at Te Pūhui. Joseph King was born at Devizes, Wiltshire, England, in May 1847. He died 1938, 83 years. Jean Henry King was born at Affleck Huntley, Aberdeen, Scotland, 1841, and died in 1934, aged 93. They were married in Auckland 17th of July 1873 by the Reverend David Bruce, Presbyterian minister, Auckland. The first son, Joseph, was born in Auckland in 1874. Then they moved to Tipu in 1875 and bought the hotel off Billy Hill. Prior to this, it consisted of three rooms with a wooden shingle roof. At Tipuhui, the other children were born. After settling in the hotel, they got busy and rebuilt the hotel, extending its size. It had a wooden shingle roof and was two-storied. It was burnt down in a bushfire in 1897. I imagine the shingle roof would have been hard to protect from a fire. After the hotel was burnt down, they lived for a few years in a hay barn, then in a tin shack called London. A home was then built where the hotel stood. This home was lived in by the family till Jim died in 1966. Then my family had fun sifting through all the rubbish, but there was nothing of value. Peter took the iron off the roof and I burnt the old house down. The hotel was rebuilt at the Hotel Lake, where the store is now. It was leased to Mrs. Joshua. The hotel at Mohooka River was then not used after they built a good bridge. So Grandfather bought it and bought it over 1899 in sections and added it onto the Tupuhui Hotel. This made a hotel of 24 bedrooms. A paragraph from the New Zealand Encyclopedia reads, 1908, Pahui Lake Hotel, 1899, 29 miles from Napier. Over 20 bedrooms, drawing, sitting room, smoking room and dining rooms, well-stocked bar, hot and cold bars, delightful back bush country walks with ferns of every variety, trout and perch in the lake, and pigeons, quail, pheasants, hares, rabbits, pigs and cattle for sportsmen. The hotel was a lunch stop for the passengers en route to Taupo, and as soon as the coach left Napier, a pigeon was released. It flew to the groomsman at the stables at Tipuhui, and he would let Granny know how many were coming for lunch. This was later used for the hotel at the lake too. The hotel was now leased to Mr. Bodley, who subleased it to others, including various names, and then sold to Alf Pothen for a house and 30 acres at Munga Territory, where the road forks to Havelock North. But the house was never lived in by the Kings. It was leased to various ones, including Smith, who was a bad tender. It eventually sold for £2,500, 1931, to help pay death duties after Grandfather died.
Amazing. I had no idea the hotel was that big. And, of course, the Kings were the original owners of the hotel, weren't they?
Yes, that's right.
So you're really retired publicans.
Yes. Yes, they were there a long time. Now, Granny Jean King hardly ever left Tipuhui. For one thing, it was a three-day trip to town, one day to get there and another to get home. Over one 18-year period, she never left Tipuhui. She and her brothers and sisters had a family reunion in New Zealand, January 29, 1920. Margaret Chalmers, Catherine Moore, Jean King, Ellen, Cheney, Williams, 90, and Alexander, 85, and James. They met at Matapu Taranaki. Soon after coming to Tipuhui, Joseph Coon took up farming, buying or leasing several sections next to the hotel. Dad said people would take up a section and would chop away at the bush for a year or two and would get sick of it and walk off or sell up. Next, he expanded down the Mohooka River, leasing 4,500 acres at Waitara in 1894 and at a later date leased another 3,000 acres. This ran 4,000 sheep, which gradually dwindled to 1,500 till Tom and Jim gave the lease up in 1933, 3 years after Joseph King died. Joseph King bought 250 acres from Bob started at Papakura, now known as Miani, for £30 an acre. Some of this block was sold off at some time. The rest was sold to the Lands and Survey for two rehab farms after the Second World War for £78 an acre, 1947. About 20 acres, which Will King kept as his share of the farm, Will had managed the farm for many years. Will died 1947 and Bessie lived there till she died. Shirley, Bessie's daughter, sold the 20 acres several years ago, 1989. The road past the old property is called King's Road. After Joseph King died in 1930 in the middle of the Great Depression, the death duty struck the Manga Territory block, and the Miani block was run by DePelsey McLeod with Will King as manager. Tom and Jim farmed at the Tipahui farm, extending it at Tipahui and giving up the white release. Peter and myself now farm the area. Now Perry and Kate King farm the area after taking over the farm at Oakmere in 1990. Joseph King also showed much enterprise in building the first mill at Tipahui. The mill was situated by the old hotel and was driven by a water wheel. The water from King's Creek was brought in a great wooden trough all across the swamp paddock. A bullock team was used to haul the logs to the mill. To drive a bullock team, a whip with an 8-foot handle and a 10-foot whip is used. All timber before the mill was built was pit sawn. Later, the Kings had a mill by the waterfall under Sam's Rock. Pedersen's also had a mill in the same region and hauled the logs over the rock and into the mill about 1936. They went bankrupt eventually. Then Orbell's hauled logs over the rock and took them to Hastings for milling. Finally, Odlands bought the beech bush and what was left of the Rimu and Mattai for £2,500 and cutting rights for 21 years, but finally gave up the cutting rights in 1957. They pushed a road in to get the timber of what is known as the Burma Road, as it was put in when the Burma Road was built for getting military supplies to China when they were fighting Japan. This road was extended by the Post and Telegraph Department when they put in the microwave tower. Started in October 1972 and completed in June 1973. At about this time, I built the airstrip for sowing super, so I was very pleased to have the road maintained for getting any super to the airstrip. It also gives us excellent access to the back of the farm. Uncle Jim retired 29 of September in 1950 and gave his share in the farm, and I paid him £50 a year. I was now in a 50-50 partnership with Dad. We crutched 1,750 ewes and hoggets. We had 1,367 ewes, 388 hoggets, 30 rams, 998 lambs crutched, and 43 bales of wool.
Who used to do your top dressing?
Lawson Field was the first top dresser that came around. He was from Gisborne. And then it was Derek Turnbull, and he did it for many years. Anyway, I don't know who does it now.
Actually, you've got some really great history there. Not often do we find a family who's been in a place for so long. That makes it quite unique. And you're talking about the mills. We've just recently got all the photos from the Tuck family. All the photos of all the milling.
Yeah, massive log. Then over the Titiokura, where the main road is, Peter farmed 500 acres where his house is, or Crowhane. The reason for the low stocking rate was the number of rabbits, and a lack of super and aerial top dressing had not started. The plague of rabbits started with three drought years, 1945, 46 and 47. There was no poison or ammunition, as things had not recovered after the war. Also, rabbiters had found traps and had gone around all the farms trapping rabbits. When you trap rabbits, you catch mostly bucks, and you also catch the stoats, ferrets and cats. You could get 2 and 6 for a rabbit skin, 8 shillings for a stoat skin, 23 shillings for a ferret skin and 5 shillings for a cat skin. With no natural predators, there was an explosion of rabbits. When poison came on the market, you could get 1,500 rabbits in a night with strychnine poison. The problem was to skin them. After the rabbit board got cracking, they used phosphorus with pollard and oats, which was very effective. Rabbiters took 22,000 skins off our farm in one winter. However, in a few years they were brought under control. By 1960-61, the sheep and cattle tallies were 1,500 sheep, 400 hogs and 70 rams, 78 cows, 7 heifers and 8 steers. I've been getting ahead here. Dad retired 1952-53 and gave his share of farm to Peter. My share was from Sam's, the Walker, and the line running from the Walker Trig to the north end of the swamp paddock, about 1,900 acres. I started putting on soup in 1953, and this raised the lambing percentage next year from the mid 70% to 100%. Average price for sheep was £2.15, average for cattle £13, and the super 20 tons. All this year I was putting in the airstrip. It was sown down 4th of February 1971. It was all bush to start. 150 tons were sown this year by field air. $7.50 a ton, average per ton $27.88. Williamson kettles 150 tons of super $2,521, and then a subsidy deduction $1,102. The Tipuhui automatic telephone was opened on the 18th of November. I have signed a contract with the P&T for the microwave station on the Walker. They buy 2 roods, 27 perches for $75. They have right of way and maintain the road to an all-weather standard at their own expense. I have the right to use the road at all times. I sold 82 acres to Rockamamon Forests for $60 an acre. This was what was known as Little Richmond. I now own 2,315 acres. This winter has been the mildest June and July on record, the mildest August in 50 years. Up to August we have had 80 inches of rain. No snow around the house for 2 years running. On January the 25th, the King family and a few friends held their centennial celebrations. It is 100 years since Grandfather King and Granny came to Tipuhui. We gathered in the afternoon on the site of the old hotel that they bought when they first came to Tipuhui. Everyone bought a plate and a bottle, and we had a barbecue under the walnut trees. It was really enjoyed by those who came.
That was 1974, was it?
Yes, that would be right. Yes. We have paid a deposit on the farm at Ohopi, the 15th of March, $46,500.
At Ohopi?
Yes.
That was quite a step away from home.
It was. Takes a while to get up there.
Do you still own it in the family?
No, we sold it when all the children went away, wasn't used. Yes, Rhonda's wedding, 7th of February, Rhonda and Rick were married. The wedding was at home and it rained all the time. 14th of March, Rhonda and Rick flew to Adelaide to get a job at a law firm.
So he's obviously a lawyer.
Yes, and Rhonda, both of them are lawyers. The Land and Survey have found it uneconomical to run the LIP leases, life and perpetuity, for the small rentals they can charge, so I've offered them to me at the original rental value. It was McGlashan's lease, and that was 160 hectares, and Tiwaka Blocks, 224 hectares. Tom Peddle lived under an overhanging rock on Rock Station. Hoare somehow tricked him out of the farm. Tom Peddle wouldn't leave, so a policeman came to move him, so he hit the policeman and then was sent to prison. After he came out, he had an operation but didn't look after his wound. He used to put Stockholm tar on the wound and finally he died. Hoare then sold to two bachelors, brothers Willie and Lock McKinnon. Willie had the farm till he died. After a few years, Dad bought it for Peter. He farmed it for some years and then sold the back portion, which is now called Crowhane. Peter kept the front 500 acres and took over Dad's share of the King's Brothers farm, 1952-53. Jim retired in 1949 and gave me his share of the farm. And then another interesting thing, there was Charlie Chadwick. He murdered the head shepherd on Rockamona and disappeared. Some time later, Will and Uncle Joe on top of Sam's Rock and came on some bones they couldn't identify. A little bit further, they came on Charlie Chadwick where he had hung himself with a rope of flax he had got from the side of the cliff. His pipe was in the fork of the tree where he had his last smoke. When the police gathered up his remains, they called at the hotel for dinner. After some time, they were startled by chanting and banging and found Charlie Chadwick's Maori wife beating the bones. He is buried at Estelle Cemetery. Firstly, outside the cemetery. After a law change, he was moved inside the cemetery. I have looked for the grave but couldn't find it.
Well, that's interesting. I never heard that. So someone that had murdered someone was never buried inside the cemetery.
No, it used to be illegal, yes. And then they changed the law. Well, I've sort of come to the end, I think.
It's fascinating. You know, there's a lot of history there, isn't there? And so you retired from the farm how many years ago?
I've been here 26 years. About that time, I retired from Te Mahui. And I bought a vineyard at Pakawai. Well, I bought the land and, yes, and planted it.
No, it didn't mention the vineyard. Whereabouts was the vineyard in the Pakawai?
It's in Allen Road, yeah.
Who did you grow for then?
Well, I used to sell on the open market. Oh. I bought 50 acres here and I didn't know what to do with it. So I planted in grapes eventually. And I used to just sell to different ones and they all lied to me.
Right. So you would have been on the riverside. So you would have been somewhere near the Marshalls, the Andersons?
Yes, Peter Marshall was, yes, next to me. John Brown. Yes. He had a dairy farm around, yes, my vineyard. Well, yeah, of course, I bought the farm off Frank Gordon. Got 50 acres there.
So that's where your vineyard is?
Yes. He had 150 acres there apparently, and he put it up for sale in 50 acre blocks. And two blocks sold, and then the other one hung fire. So anyway, I came along, and at that stage, you know, and a chap from Williamson Kettle said, oh, there's 50 acres down there, you know.
Yes.
So I bought it.
Oh, that's fascinating. So do you still own your vineyard?
Yes. My son bought it off me. That was Dennis, and well, Dennis died in, well, March this year, and it was a big loss. He was such a clever fellow, you know, really clever fellow. And anyway, his wife owns it now, and she leases it out. Dennis got sick of running it. He was losing money each year, you know, at that stage, grapes weren't paying. And anyway, so he started leasing it out for 5 years, I think, a Dutchman. Anyway, they still own it.
The wine industry is very strong again now.
Yes, well, the chap who leases it, he took all the grapes out and plants onions and peas and stuff.
So does the family still own Te Pahui?
Yes, my son's up there, Perry's. Yes,
so it still goes on. Well, that's wonderful. So here, Joe, you sit and you look out over towards Whirinaki.
I can see the farm, actually, just out there, just out the window. Yes. I can see Te Pahui.
Those of us that have been around a long time use lots of landmarks because we know exactly where things are.
I know all that range and all the Kaweka range intimately, you know. Mm.
Well, you and your family have rung the changes, haven't you, when you look from going into an area that was bush. And then you made a remark about everything reverted back to Manuka and Kānuka. Mm. Did you then have to break it all in again?
Some of it, yeah. We're pretty lucky where I farm. They didn't take the bush off straight away. We just gradually. Mm. And so when the bush finally went, we had good years.
Because the 50s, they gave farmers the opportunity to actually do some development, put some fertiliser on and get a return.
Yes, when I started farming, there was only 5 resident farmers left in the whole district up there. Just amazing, really. Everybody had walked off or sold up or something. Most of them had just walked off.
But as you said, tough times with rabbits.
Yes. When I took over, I must have had 1 million rabbits on the farm, I reckon. Yes.
Yes, well, that's good. Well, actually, that's probably...
Is that enough, is it?
I think that's wonderful, actually. Thank you very much, Joe, for allowing me to tape it.